The United States is currently fighting wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. U.S. military forces are spread across the globe. The Department of Defense spends nearly $600 billion a year. President-elect Donald Trump has said that he wants more troops, more planes, and more ships. That's going to require a lot more spending. But Mr. Trump also has raised questions about the effectiveness of ongoing U.S. participation in alliance and defense treaties. Take NATO, for example. He's argued that the countries the United States helps to defend do not pay their fair share for defending themselves. In a speech in Philadelphia back in September, then-candidate Trump said that under his administration, the United States would rethink the policies of the past while making America strong again.
Today I'm here to talk to you about three crucial words that should be at the center always of our foreign policy. Peace through strength.
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I'm Robert McMahon, Managing Editor of CFR.org.
You're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the challenges that President-elect Donald Trump will face after Inauguration Day on January 20, 2017. On this show, we talk about the issues that he will find at the top of his inbox when he arrives in the Oval Office. We're going to discuss what he has said he will do, what his priorities might be, and what challenges he could likely confront. This week, we're going to talk about defense and national security. How will President-elect Trump handle those priorities during his administration?
With us this week to help examine those priorities is CFR's Carla Ann Robbins. Carla is an adjunct senior fellow with expertise on U.S. national security policy. She also teaches national security studies at Baruch College's School of Public Affairs. You might also know her in her former roles as deputy editorial page editor at The New York Times and chief diplomatic correspondent at The Wall Street Journal. Carla, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, Carla, to kick things off, what do you see as the likely first steps of President-elect Trump on the area of defense?
Well, he, in the beginning, when he was campaigning, was suggesting that we were spending too much on defense and that he was going to do away with the waste, fraud, and abuse, and felt that we were overextended and we're going to cut back and focus mainly at home. Although, like so many other things in the campaign, as it progressed, he embraced a much more assertive and in many ways a much more traditional Republican stance, said he wanted to increase the defense budget. He seems completely focused on the notion of counterterrorism, but he seems to be describing it in a much more traditional way. So he wants more troops and, as Jim said, more ships and more planes. So I can't really predict which way he's going to go on this, because when you add to that one really absolutely essential fact, which is he's constrained by the Budget Control Act. He can't spend more on defense unless he goes back to the Congress and he changes the rules of spending. So he can talk about spending more. He can talk about building up the military. He can talk about being more assertive in a traditional military way, but he's got to work out his relationship with the Congressional, you know, the Congress about that also.
Well, let's draw you out on that, Carla, because obviously President-elect Trump, when he becomes president, will face a Republican Congress, many of whom over the last several years have argued for spending more on defense. They will have the option of rewriting the Budget Control Act and the rules under which spending is made. What would be the impediments, assuming they rewrite the rules to allow more spending, to spending an extra 10, 15, or 20% on the U.S. military?
Well, what's so interesting about this is you've got two sorts of Republicans on the Hill. You've got two sorts of hawks. You've got defense hawks and you've got deficit hawks. And when the Budget Control Act was first negotiated with the White House, it was based on the premise that the Republicans would care more about protecting defense spending than they would about the deficit. And it turned out that they cared more about the deficit. What we don't know is, are they so dazzled by this unexpected win by President-elect Trump that they're going to go back on that? And this goes far beyond defense spending. I mean, he's got much bigger commitments here, mainly, you know, the potentially $1 trillion, you know, infrastructure plan as well, which is domestic spending, which is his number one concern. So he's got to go back and renegotiate the Budget Control Act if he's going to live up to any of the commitments that he's made. And certainly if he wants to bring the Republicans along on that, I think, you know, he's going to have to commit to big defense spending, because that's certainly the thing that John McCain, who's a huge Trump skeptic, or Lindsey Graham really want.
So, Carla, let's just assume he gets what he's asking for, or at least a good bit of what he's asking for. What then? What does the Trump administration focus on in terms of defense priorities?
Well, this is one of the great puzzles about this, which is, when he talks about national security, it is repeatedly about what he doesn't want to do, how much less he wants to do than what the Obama administration has done or what he predicted a Hillary Clinton administration would do. He wants to pull back from Europe. He wants to pull back from Asia. He doesn't want to fight big wars like the wars in Iraq or Afghanistan, which then raises the question, why does he want 540,000, a 20% increase in the number of Army ground troops even to begin with? So I'm not sure what he wants it for, other than the fact that perhaps it's, you know, it's Republicans traditionally want, you know, bigger military spending itself. His number one commitment is counterterrorism. It is fighting ISIS, which he sees as a mortal threat to the United States, the number one national security existential threat to the United States. He doesn't see Russia as the number one national security threat. He does see China as a threat, and we can talk more about that, but he usually defines that much more in economic terms than he does in military terms. So ISIS, which he does define as a military threat, he appears to define that in military terms. But where would he be fighting ISIS? Because he doesn't seem to want to expand the fight in Iraq, although there are times when he talked about he'd be much more aggressive in places like Mosul, but he would have done it secretly. In Syria, he seems to want to let the Russians take the lead. So it really is a puzzle where he would be doing this really aggressively with this really big military.
Looking at counterterrorism, is it that the Trump administration is going to look at it solely as a problem for the U.S. military? Or does it have a broader integrated strategy for dealing with counterterrorism?
I have not heard, I don't know if you have, I have not heard a broader integrated strategy. Certainly, as we've talked about before, I believe in that counterterrorism is ultimately a police and intelligence challenge, not really a, you know, hard force military challenge itself. Because, okay, so you drive ISIS out of Iraq. Where do they go? They go to Syria, they go to Somalia, they go to someplace else. And this is a generational long war itself. And having a huge military to go after it, particularly if you don't want to invade places, which is what, you know, President-elect Trump has made clear. So what we've heard from him is, I would be better at it. I know it better than the generals. I would be certainly be much more aggressive with ISIS. But in the particular theaters where we see the war right now, about which he has spoken, which is mainly Syria, he seems to want to let the Russians do the job.
Well, and let me just ask a little bit more about that. It definitely ISIS seems to be the very frontline priority. But it's also the sense of raised by both President-elect Trump and his senior aides of radical Islamic terrorism. And they made a point of that in the campaign trail at the Republican convention, calling it out as an issue that they said Democrats dared not say its name. And they're making a big point of this. So this then is even more than ISIS. It's taking on this notion of that there are radical Islamic terrorists out there who are posing the existential threat to the U.S.
Yes, but much of that is focused domestically. This is wall building. You know, at times they've talked about a Muslim registry, about surveilling mosques or even potentially, you know, closing mosques itself. Certainly, first there was the discussion of banning that you know, President-elect Trump had said he was going to ban the admission for a while until we understand what the hell is going on, admission of Muslims, of refugees or immigrants. Then they said banning the admission of people from countries where there had been terrorist attacks. Of course, that would mean, you know, potentially from France. So they seem to have basically their notion of counterterrorism at home, which is his number one concern, which it should be the number one concern of any president, is much more focused on wall building than it is on anything else. We haven't heard a lot about, you know, about counterterrorism cooperation with allies itself. He was very, very critical of NATO, felt that it didn't have a counterterrorism strategy, which, of course, is not true, and then congratulated them, he believed, for being pressed for him for suddenly talking about counterterrorism itself. On the other hand, you know, I will give him a small amount of credit here for, I believe, correctly identifying the notion that, you know, direct occupations of places like Iraq and Afghanistan is not going to solve your problem. It certainly, you can drain, oh my God, am I using this term, drain the swamp in one place, and then there's going to be ISIS someplace else. So yes, perhaps if we get past that notion of extended occupations, which the Obama administration had also rejected, although it was having a very hard time getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan, that perhaps is the next thought. But we don't have the next thought from him about how he would fight that fight. And we're certainly not hearing the talk about counterterrorism as a long-term police action or a long-term counterintelligence problem.
Well, let's talk about a specific example of potentially the military aspect of dealing with counterterrorism. I take your point, Carla, that in the United States, you're talking about domestic counterterrorism. That's not the responsibility of the Department of Defense. Spending more money on the Department of Defense is not going to solve that issue.
The Department of Defense is barred from doing it by law.
But abroad, there is a military component to any counterterrorism policy. And let's talk about a specific case, which would be Syria. How do you see the Trump administration approaching Syria in the counterterrorism context?
President-elect Trump's number one concern is defeating ISIS. ISIS's presence, most assertive and biggest presence right now, is in Syria, since they appear to be making some progress in beating ISIS back in Iraq. At the same time, we don't hear from President-elect Trump an interest in continuing or expanding the Obama administration's training program for allegedly moderate opponents of the Assad regime. And we certainly don't hear him talking about extending the bombing program. If anything, what we're hearing from him is the idea of let the Russians do it. Let the Russians increase their bombing and step back. It seems like, you know, the way they talk about it in a very real politic isn't that economical. Let the Russians do the bombing. Now, what of course raises are some pretty fundamental questions here. Would there really be stability in Syria if you destroyed even more of Syria if Bashar al-Assad was left, the last man left standing, and he'd kill 600,000 or 700,000 people with the support of the Russians and the tacit support of the United States? Do we as a country want to be tacitly supporting war crimes? There are lots of moral issues here, but there are also strategic issues here and stability issues here. Does that really defeat ISIS or the next terrorist group that's going to come along? Because I believe you're going to have mass chaos in Syria even with the defeat of ISIS and Bashar al-Assad allegedly in control. But right now, what we're hearing from Trump is basically let the Russians do it with our tacit support or maybe even our overt support.
Assume for a second that the Trump administration goes in that direction with the caveat here, nobody knows what the Trump administration will do until it does it. Wouldn't one of the problems facing the Trump administration be that American allies in that region, I'm thinking particularly Saudi Arabia,
and Turkey,
United Arab Emirates, also thinking Turkey, are firmly opposed to going down that road? How would a Trump administration try to square that circle?
Well, and that is very puzzling, because how does it also square the circle for President-elect Trump as well, who has defined Iran as a major enemy for the United States, without seeming to take into account the fact that Iran is an ally of both the Bashar Assad government and the Russians in Syria, and there are Iranian-backed forces fighting on the ground in Syria in support of Assad. Yes, profoundly alienate the Sunnis around it. He doesn't seem to be particularly concerned of that. He has been very, very dismissive of the Saudis and hasn't said much about the Turks that I'm aware of. And you can say that they certainly are not the best of allies. And the Turkey's increasingly authoritarian, the Saudis are profoundly authoritarian, although you also don't hear President-elect Trump talking a lot about human rights and concerns about democracy itself. I see this as letting this war continue to rage without some sort of political settlement as fundamentally further destabilizing for the region. And if there are going to be any near-term winners, it's going to be Iran. And I don't see a squaring of the circle, and I haven't even heard any mention of this from the Trump crowd itself. He wants to make common cause with Russia, but he doesn't seem to understand that Iran is also the other key player there.
I would also add that, because of the position so far announced, or the positions expressed about Russia and about NATO allies, that if we move the discussion a little bit north, there's a great deal of trepidation about what a Trump administration, what its posture would be vis-a-vis Russian moves in Ukraine. There's a great deal of tension now on these sort of NATO front lines, the Baltic states, the extent to which the U.S. should be supporting Ukraine. Do you see an abrupt shift in the U.S. support for, let's say, the Baltic states or NATO frontline allies that are sort of close proximity to Russian forces?
Well, I think the most shocking thing that we heard from candidate Trump was the suggestion that he would not live up to the Article 5, all for one, one for all fundamental commitment of the NATO treaty to countries that didn't pay up their full dues. And of course, there's no real notion of what full dues are. There are guidelines on what percentage of your GDP should be committed to defense spending.
They're committing by their own voice to 2% of their GDP, and only five countries in NATO have done so.
Yeah, us and four more. On the other hand, there's nothing in the treaty that says if you don't go, that's a soft commitment, right. And it's only since 2006. And there's nothing that says, and if you don't pay up, suddenly we're not going to protect you, which implies somehow that we don't have an interest in the stability of other of our allies in Europe, or the notion of the success or the continued success or even existence of the NATO alliance. So this is the most shocking thing that he said. And I was at a conference in Canada a couple of weeks ago, and I would say that the number one thing that I heard, and not just from Europeans, I heard it from the Japanese, I heard it from people in Latin America, absolutely frightened by the notion that the United States was going to bail on NATO, was going to bail on its alliance commitments, was going to make common cause with an authoritarian government in Russia. What was that itself going to mean? So there are several things going on here. One is, what does this mean for our stature around the world, for our reliability as an ally? The second thing is, we know what we heard him say. What did Putin hear him say? Which then goes back to your question itself. What happens now in Ukraine? Does Putin lie back? Or does he take more of Ukraine itself? And how does, you know, a president-elect Trump respond? I don't think he does anything, God forbid, if Putin decides that this is an open door. The second question is, of course, does he then start messing around, send more little green men, as we used to talk about them, into the Baltics itself? I mean, he wants the Baltics. He wants these countries that are around Russia that he feels should never have been allowed into NATO in the first place.
We're talking Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia.
Yes, that would be a massive, massive threat and could crack the alliance for all times itself. Certainly, I mean, there's been all sorts of gaming. It would take the Russians about 36 hours to roll over those places. Now, right now, there are a small number of NATO troops, including American troops, that have been forward deployed into the Baltics and into the region itself. And the United States has made the commitment to, and we're talking about hundreds, we're not talking about thousands and thousands of troops, but they're there symbolically in part as a tripwire to show the American commitment and to make clear to Putin, Ukraine's not in NATO. We didn't send troops to stop you from doing it, but the NATO commitment is real. And then Putin hears him saying, well, this is very transactional. You don't pay your dues. I'm not going to live up to the Article 5 commitment. So what does Putin take from that? Maybe he thinks that the potential of getting sanctions lifted and future alliance with Trump means he doesn't start messing around. Or maybe he pushes the limits. We don't know. This could very well be an early crisis.
If Mr. Trump wanted to reassure NATO allies about his commitment to the alliance, given what he has said in the past, how would he do it? Can he provide reassurance? Or is it the case that since he signaled that he might view it in a transactional form, he can't roll that back?
Oh, he can roll it back. He's rolled back his statements on climate change. He's rolled back lots of statements on torture.
No. I guess my point is, how do you persuade the audience that you really mean it? I mean, one of the things Mr. Trump has talked about is how he likes uncertainty. He thinks it's an advantage. I think a lot of people who study international relations say, under some circumstances, uncertainty is good. In other circumstances, uncertainty is incredibly dangerous, particularly when you have an alliance commitment. So I guess my question is, can Mr. Trump provide that reassurance to the allies?
No, you're right. And I'm going to answer that, but I want to go back to the uncertainty thing because you raise a really, really important point here, is that the uncertainty is really fundamental both for the panic potential of the smaller members of NATO who have always tried to figure out, do I want to give in a little bit more to the Russians, or am I solidly finally in the West itself? So they may be hedging their bets, rethinking their relationship right now, even as we speak. And then there's also the uncertainty of Putin. Is Putin going to start testing immediately, even before President Trump is really in there and has understood things? So we could have an early crisis potentially because Putin may not know what he heard either. He may see this as an open door. If President Trump comes in and somebody says to him, you know, this is really a dangerous game itself, and the United States has a huge economic and national security interest in the NATO alliance, which I personally could make that argument, but he hasn't called me.
Well, his vice president made that point during the debate. He mapped out a very different approach to Russia than Mr. Trump had on the campaign trail.
And you're going to hear it again and again and again from John McCain. You're going to hear it from Lindsey Graham. You're going to hear it from people in the Congress who he's going to want to support him. So it's been the number one thing that John McCain has been pushing him on since the election itself. So how could he reassure them? He could take a trip to Europe. He could say, I'm committed to keeping the sanctions on for a while. He could say, I'm committed to keeping those forward deployed troops in the Baltics and troops in Poland or Romania or Bulgaria or wherever, that, you know, it's not a huge economic commitment. But what he could say is, I get it, the NATO alliance is an important thing, but I, you know, I'm a tough bargainer. And as I got the carrier plant to say, to keep half the number of you know, workers, I'm going to get X, Y, and Z countries to up their commitment a little bit more. So, you know, they believe me, they would be so happy to get Trump on their side. And I suppose he could claim it as another victory itself. Yeah, maybe they're going to put a little bit more money in next year for the sake of him recommitting to Article 5. And he can pocket that as another big win.
While we're talking about alliances, there's another important U.S. ally in Asia, Japan. Its leader, Shinzo Abe, was the first leader to visit Trump in Trump Tower. He talked about certainly the TPP deal that seems to be dead in the water, but also certainly security issues came up. Are there things that Trump can say in that theater that will reassure the Japanese allies?
Well, this is really fascinating because one of the other things he said that I think freaked people out an enormous amount was he implied that we were getting a bad economic deal, since everything's totally transactional, in with having American troops in South Korea and in Japan, as if somehow they were just there to defend those countries rather than U.S., you know, U.S., the fact that the U.S. had an interest in global power projection, and that he wanted them to somehow pay us or pay more or something for that. And he also implied that since they weren't paying enough, that maybe they couldn't depend on the extended nuclear deterrence that the United States has, which then raised the question that was raised, and this was in the interviews with the New York Times. Well, does that mean you'd be comfortable with them having their own nuclear weapons? And while it wasn't a full-throated yes, it was an implied yes. And he has now claimed that he never said that. But if you go back and you read the transcripts, there's no question that that's what he was saying. So it was interesting that Abe came. It was interesting that President-elect Trump did not ask for a briefing from the Pentagon, the State Department, the NSC, before the meeting itself. I don't think he had a U.S. government translator with him. I find the whole thing quite interesting, the way that he transacts early diplomacy. So once again, we don't know what he said to Abe or what Abe heard, but Abe thought it was rather important to be in there first. It's a sign of his anxiety. I think the Trump people would say, look, I talk tough. They come to my door itself. Now, is Abe certainly willing to spend more in defense? He's a tough guy. He's always been willing to spend more in defense. The thing that worries me, and I think people should generally be worried about, what we've been hearing ever since President-elect Trump, as candidate Trump, started talking that way, is we've been hearing many more voices in South Korea in particular talk about the need, because of the threat from North Korea, to consider having their own nuclear weapons program. The Japanese themselves are always 6 months away from having a nuclear capability. They produce a huge amount of plutonium from their nuclear program. They could do it. We're not hearing it as much from Japan. But, you know, once again, this is the sort of thing that he has to be very reassuring that he doesn't want to pull the troops out, very reassuring, because another early potential crisis is North Korea itself, which is a huge threat not just to South Korea but also to Japan when you consider how close it is. And every time the North Koreans test something, it goes right over Japan or right towards Japan. He's got to be reassuring, and he has to be reassuring on the extended deterrence itself, because if not, you are going to see conservative people in South Korea and Japan talking about the notion of reviving their own nuclear weapons program.
They're already talking about it. But let me take the other side of the argument. Why would it be bad for the United States to see South Korea or Japan get their own nuclear capacity? It would certainly solve the problem of extended deterrence, the idea, you know, would the United States fire nuclear weapons and put itself at risk on behalf of another country?
Because it is only by sheer luck that we haven't had a nuclear war. You know, the notion somehow that has been nuclear stability and nobody's used a nuclear weapon except for us since World War II is, you know, I can tell you, you know, there are many, many times, and several times in which we've come close, including between India and Pakistan. You know, the fact that we came that close.
Also between the United States and the Soviet Union.
I was about to talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis, which may seem like it was a very long time ago, but for several of us here on this podcast, it seems like just yesterday.
That it does.
And, you know, nuclear weapons are fundamentally destabilizing. It's very easy to miscalculate here. And the difference between miscalculating conventional war and a nuclear war is pretty damn big. And so they are destabilizing. You really don't want them. You can really mess your day up. And the more nuclear weapon states that are out there, the higher the chance that there is of that. You know, the goal should be to cut back the number of states with nuclear weapons, not to encourage more. And that's always been the great advantage of extended deterrence, was to say, let's try to stabilize things while we work on the few number of states that actually have nuclear weapons to cut back the numbers there to lessen the chance of miscalculation or an accident.
But there's one country, obviously, in Northeast Asia that has acquired nuclear weapons, and that is destabilizing. I'm speaking, obviously, about North Korea. Do we have a sense of how the Trump administration would deal with the threat posed by North Korea? And I should point out, right now, North Korea does not have the capacity, the established capacity, to hit the United States with an intercontinental ballistic missile. The most common number I hear from people is, wait 5 years and that will happen. But many people argue that the game has already changed in Northeast Asia because the North Koreans can hit South Korea and they can hit Japan.
So it's not that they don't have... They probably have the missile capability. They don't have the capability to miniaturize the weapon to get on the top of the missile, from my understanding of their technological competence. And they're fizzles and they test things all the time, but they're clearly racing toward that. That is their goal itself. So, you know, if I were to predict two early testing crises, one is Putin, Ukraine messing around in the Balts, and the other one is crazy North Koreans. And crazy North Koreans with nuclear weapons. And we have heard nothing from the Trump crowd about North Korea itself. And that is pretty scary because, let's face it, you know, you really don't want North Korea with many more nuclear weapons because we don't know what they're going to do. This is not a rational, easily deterrable country. The country that has the most leverage with them because they're economically dependent on them is China. Trump has been very, very in your face to Beijing. This is not a country that he's going to make an easy common cause with the way he's talking about making common cause with Putin. So the possibility of constraining North Korea is there. And the reality is you could say, well, okay, let's take out, we have a pretty good idea where they, you know, produce all their, you know, they're highly enriched uranium, small amount of it, where they, you know, extract their plutonium. We know where they do this. They probably haven't hidden all that much there. We know where their missiles are. Let's, you know, take it all out with a blinding strike. The problem is they have a huge conventional capability to destroy Seoul, the capital of South Korea, one of our most important allies itself. This is something that I don't have an answer for, that the Obama administration didn't have an answer for, that going back to the Clinton administration didn't have an answer for.
Well, the George W. Bush administration didn't have an answer for. This is independent of political affiliation.
Yes, there was that in there too. But what I'm saying is going back for a really long time, as they have been building this nuclear capability, no one has had either a conventional military answer to this problem itself. So they try, and it's always Lucy in the football, and you know they don't really... They haven't been able to negotiate a settlement with the North Koreans themselves, who seem determined and believe their only chance for survival is with nuclear weapons. And, you know, so diplomacy seems like the only solution. And the only leverage that you have out there is with the Chinese. And Trump seems to be, if anything, wanting to go to at least a trade war with the Chinese. So I think this gets even more complicated in a Trump administration. And if I had to worry, you know, about the possibility of one place blowing up big time in the near term, it's North Korea. That's the one I worry about. And I worry about, you know, the destruction that could be wreaked on South Korea because of it.
And apparently the initial conversation that President-elect Trump had with President Obama, President Obama tried to convey to him that particular issue in particular as a very worrying one, an alarming one. As you said, President-elect Trump on the campaign trail, there wasn't a lot about what he would do there. He did invoke China in all sorts of ways and in all sorts of negative ways, including somehow pressing China to do the right thing vis-a-vis North Korea, but nothing else that I have seen, which is more nuanced.
No, if anything, I mean, there seems to be no attempt to jolly the Chinese. And certainly, you know, we can have cross-cutting interests with big powers in which you cooperate on some things and compete with them on others. But you have heard nothing from President-elect Trump about China, about cooperating. You've heard, except for the notion of, you know, what you've heard is you know, is direct confrontation.
Well, this gets us back to sort of what are the perceived frontline threats that the Trump administration sees facing the United States. A great deal about the so-called Islamic State. And then you get to domestic, and you get to this sort of the threat within, the porous borders, the loose vetting, in their words, of people who come to live in the United States. And so it then becomes a little bit commingled with other departments, not necessarily a defense issue per se. So anything else on the defense umbrella that we should be looking out for?
He is going to have to, first of all, deal with the funding issue. That's the number one issue he's going to have to decide. And he's going to have to decide that across the board. He has got a Budget Control Act, and he's going to have to figure out whether he wants to break that. And he did not run as a traditional Republican in the sense of deficits were his number one national security threat or his number one domestic security threat. And whether the Republican Party is willing to go along with him, they certainly weren't willing to go along with him for most of the campaign, but they see him. He seems to have magic with him.
Well, and it's also worth pointing out that Republican Congress has been much more comfortable with deficit spending when the president was a Republican.
Oh, sure.
I mean, that happened with George W. Bush. And I do think in this case with Mr. Trump, if you look at all of his policies taken together, he wants to cut taxes substantially, and he wants to spend a lot more on defense, and he doesn't want to cut major entitlement programs like Medicare. It's hard to imagine how you do all of those things and not see the deficit get much bigger. And again, as you note, there are still deficit hawks, most of them Republicans, on Capitol Hill. So something has to give.
Yeah, I mean, we could end up seeing massive deficits run up, and then the Republicans are going to have to figure out which cathedral they are praying in. They have been on the deficit cathedral for a very long period of time, but they didn't seem to really mind it with Ronald Reagan and somewhat with George W., and massively, actually, after a while with George W. So we really don't know what way the Republicans. He is not a traditional Republican. They were not happy with him as a candidate. They seem to have to make some pretty fundamental questions there about that. But what he is giving them, at least on the national security defense spending thing, is a much more traditional, let's go spend lots of money on national security, which they always seem very happy with. The question becomes, what domestic programs, and there is some talk about potentially massive cuts in other parts of defense, of domestic spending, but he also wants to have some large infrastructure programs as well.
Yeah, but I will note, if you look at domestic spending, leaving aside entitlements, putting aside interest on the national debt, putting aside defense spending, you're only talking about 16% of the overall federal budget to go for all the things we normally associate with government, roads, and the like. And there's actually not that much money, certainly not enough to cover what was likely to be the deficit you're going to witness if the other parts of the plan come through. I should know the answer to this question, but I don't. And do we know when the next time Congress will have to deal with raising the ceiling on the national debt?
It comes reasonably frequently. And
because that would actually sort of force a discussion about this very issue.
And they've never had a problem with it when they were Republicans, so I doubt that they're going to have a problem now. I mean, the infrastructure thing is something that Obama was pushing. It's borrowing is very inexpensive right now. I thought it was a good idea with Obama. I'm not going to have a particularly, big problem with it under a Republican president itself. I never felt that we had to balance our budget completely. We have lots of good faith and credit of the U.S. government. But how he does the infrastructure plan and, whether it really does put people back to work and whether or not we are, you can't really pay for things by just cutting waste, fraud, and abuse. And that's what we're hearing right now. We're just talking about that. And he's also talking about, once again, cutting taxes for rich people. And what we saw before in other Republican administrations is that's not the stimulus that Republicans tend to claim that it is.
Well, that brings us back full circle on this discussion on U.S. defense policy. And we'll close up the president's inbox for this week. Carla, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Be sure to subscribe to the president's inbox on iTunes and leave us a review while you're at it. It really helps. Please note that opinions expressed in the president's inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazzo, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick and recording engineers Glenn Goldman and John Fletcher. Special thanks to Audrey Bowler and Bardia Viseggi. This is Jim Lindsay.
And this is Robert McMahon. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on The President's Inbox.